Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, I have all sorts of wonderful things to talk with you about before I can even start talking with you about biology this morning. So let me run through some announcements real quick. First of all, let's talk about the homework assignment that was due last Friday. And I know several of you have walked by and to pick up your homework assignment and walked away really sad because you couldn't find it there. Here they are. They're going to go out there after lecture. I just wanted to say something about them before I put them out. And that is that, believe it or not, there are times when things get so busy that I just can't get everything done that I need to get done. And this is one of those times as we get to the end of the term. And so I thought that for this particular homework assignment, I would let you all grade your own assignments. Does that sound like fun? Now, what I did, though, is to, if you turn in the assignment, and if you answered every question, you got full credit. Okay, don't assume, though, that every answer you put down is correct. So you're going to need to look at the grading key that I'll post out there also. But as long as you did that, then you got full credit, kind of a little gift, I think, to both of us. And that's how this one went down. So I'll have these out there. Once I get done with lecture and get a chance before I go into lab, they'll be out there and you can pick them up. Second thing, I got an email. You all got an email, most of you probably are aware of this, from Enrollment Services telling you that this is your big opportunity to evaluate the classes you've been taking. And they've been twisting people's arms for the last couple of terms to get them to do the evaluation, and the way that they're twisting your arm this time is that they say that until you have evaluated all of your courses, all of the ones that you can evaluate, and I know sometimes there are courses you can't evaluate, but then they shouldn't show up on your list of courses that you can evaluate. Until you've done that, there's a hold on your account that prevents you from registering for classes, seeing grades, and ordering transcripts. And that hold will end at 5 o'clock on Friday, March 29th, which is like the last Friday of break. So be aware of that. The invitation to evaluate your classes is out there. And the email would have gone to your SOU account. So if you never look at your SOU account, it's probably a good time to look at your SOU account and see what's there. Anyway, please get on there and evaluate the courses. It's important for us to know what you're thinking. Third announcement, of course, is the final exam that's coming up a week from Thursday. Nothing surprising on here, I hope. It is cumulative. Typically, it's about 40% from the previous two exam periods. Not the same questions by any means, but the same material. And then about 60% from the material since the last exam. When I go back and write questions for that earlier material, I try to ask myself, you know, what are the carryaway concepts? What are the things that I think you really should be carrying away from this class? I think that the way that I write that, the questions maybe aren't as in detail, as picky or whatever, and you might accuse me of being picky on any midterm. But of course, the material I haven't tested you on, it'll be in more detail than just like a midterm. But the earlier stuff, I'm kind of thinking, what is it that you should be carrying out of this class? So if that helps you as you're studying, hopefully as you studied for the midterms, you took time to use the review questions that are in the lecture note packet. Hopefully you wrote your answers down for those so you've got a reference point where you can go back and use those to kind of help you to refresh that material in your minds. So that will be coming. The last couple of readings, the last three lab exercises that we've done, there will be some questions there. Remember, I told you, especially pay close attention to that lab that we did on meiotic cell division, because there will be questions specifically on stages of meiotic cell division and things like that that occurred in that lab. So make sure you take a look at that. Exam is usually about double the questions, it's double the points, 200 points instead of 100 points. You'll have a full 2 hours to take that exam, and that should be plenty of time for you to get that exam done and more. I've scheduled a couple of question and answer sessions, Tuesday at 12:30, Wednesday at 3. This time it's in our lab room, okay? Not the other room. It's in the lab room that we've been meeting in all term for that and so forth. Don't forget, if you do at least 10% better on the final compared to your two midterms, base corrected to the 100-point scale for the midterms, so 200 points worth of midterms. What am I saying? If you do at least 10% better than that, then I will double your exam score, your final exam score, and I will eliminate the two midterms. So if, especially if you're really struggling in the class, it's an opportunity to improve your score. Get in there and study as best as you can for this final exam. And you have the potential of improving your score two ways. The 10% thing would really help, but even you might do a whole lot better even if you don't make the 10% than you've done on the two midterms, and so that would improve your score also. Okay, so that is coming up, and we'll be in here that Thursday morning taking that exam. So I think, unless I've forgotten something, it's been a crazy morning. It was great until I got down here and started putting out all the stuff I normally put out and discovered what I didn't remember to bring with me. So I've been going back and forth to my office, collecting everything up. I hope I got everything together for the lecture today. So we'll see. Anyway, that's everything that I can think of right now. So, what have we been doing? Last time we reviewed the meiotic cell division, remember? And little bullet points down there, kind of in the middle. Be sure to know the process. Okay, especially what's going on in prophase one and anaphase one, where we're some really unique things going on that we don't see in mitotic division. Be sure to know the result of meiosis. You know, that we're reducing the ploidy, the number of complete sets of chromosomes, by half as a result of that, and we're getting these new genetic combinations that are showing up and so forth. So make sure you pay close attention to that, as well as being able to recognize the different stages of that process. So we looked at that, and then we got into human male gamete production. And I told you that in male gamete production is pretty much down the line like a meiotic division. We start off with one diploid cell, we wind up with four haploid cells. Each of those four haploid cells then becomes a spermatozoan. And we looked at that process. I kind of drew that out schematically for you. It would behoove you to remember that process that I drew out. Remember, in the seminiferous tubule, we've got these cells, these stem cells, that are constantly dividing mitotically over here, the spermatogonia, that produce a spermatocyte that's going to undergo meiosis and another spermatogonia. So the key to this whole thing is having kind of an unlimited supply of spermatozoa in the form of these spermatocytes that are being formed by this continual mitotic division of the spermatogonium. That gives males kind of an unlimited resource there in terms of producing spermatozoa. We saw that the spermatocytes then will undergo meiosis and eventually will mature into the spermatozoa. The spermatogonia continue on as stem cells, constantly dividing mitotically and again producing a new spermatogonium and a new spermatocyte that's going to undergo meiosis. So we saw that going on in the case of male reproduction. And then we also tracked the route. Then we saw that the mature spermatozoans are released into the lumen, into the inside of that seminiferous tubule, and then they'll migrate to the epididymis where they're stored until such time as they're called upon and released. So that was the male reproduction. I thought I would start this lecture with kind of an odd video that I came across a little while ago that will kind of bring some of this to life for some of you. So let me see if I can get that up and running. And it should actually be waiting for us. Let's see if it is. Oh, look, there it is. Wonderful. I kind of wonder sometimes why you make these videos.
Let us now make a longitudinal cut in the tunica albuginea of the testis, which has just been removed.
So that's the testis that he's cutting open.
The seminiferous tubule may be pulled from the testis as long, delicate threads. If one of these tubules is placed on a microscope slide and the surrounding fluid withdrawn gradually, the cellular content exudes from the cup handle. Sperm and the seminiferous tubules occur in groups with their heads embedded in Schapoda sacs. All sperm in this segment show a slight vibratory or undulatory movement. Occasionally, the tips of the flagella appear to be bled. The significance of these bleds is unknown. Free sperm may be present also. Their flagella may be curved slightly and show mild vibratory movements. Their heads normally remain in one plane. Very occasionally, a sperm will appear to rotate slowly. The morphology of the head can be appreciated in a rotating sperm, for the edge of the head appears as a bright flash. We emphasize that the rate of sperm movement has been recorded at normal speed throughout this challenge. When spermatozoa are recovered from the ductile aberrantes and examined with phase objectives, they show the same motility pattern as those taken from the seminiferous tubules. An occasional sperm may show more vigorous vibration of the flagellum.
So these are in the epididymis now, and they go into
the majority are capable of only weak vibratory movements. They make little or no forward progress. Note that the cytoplasmic droplet is located at the base of the head. This is a segment of one of the ductile aberrantes showing the strong ciliary currents within the tubule. This is quite characteristic of segment 2. But even here, the majority are unable to rotate or to make any forward progress. Segment 3 is the point of flexure of the head of the epididymis. A variety of swimming movements are evident in this segment. Note the forward movement shown by one sperm in this preparation. Notice also that a few sperm are showing a slow, circular form of movement. In these individuals, there is a distinct curve in the region of the midpiece. The flagellum in motion appears somewhat more linear. But even so, the majority still show the tight circular movement that is so characteristic of the preceding segment. Segment 6 comprises the upper half of the body of the epididymis. A few sperm are now capable of moving straight forward. Many still move in circles, but in most cases, the circle appears to be wider than seen in previous segments. Note that many show rotation of their heads as they move forward, but there are others in which the heads do not rotate. In these cases, the rapidity of flagellar movement gives the impression of vibrations of a tuning fork. Such sperm often move in wide circles, rather than straight forward, which is so characteristic of the swimming movements of mature rabbit spermatozoa. The flagella appear more or less straight. A few sperm retain the droplet, and when present, it is located at the junction of the midpiece and the main piece.
Okay, enough fun for one day. So that gives you an idea of actually what's going on in the testy and the seminiferous tubule. You saw the what we call mature sperm, but you also saw in this video that there's a continuing process that goes on in terms of maturation of the sperm, and even in the epididymis and so forth. So you might wonder, well, what happens if sperm stay there too long? Can sperm get old? Yes, sperm can get old. And if they stay there in the epididymis for a long period of time, they'll just degenerate. Okay, and they'll be replaced by new ones, by new spermatozoans. So that's what's going on there. You got a feel for what they look like. And I was so disappointed that he had to mention that was rabbit sperm, because I was going to tell you that was a volunteer's testicle that got cut open, but I guess I won't go down that road. Anyway, so that's that. Now, what I want to talk about today, or what I want to at least start off with today, is talking about female gamete reproduction. Okay, it's different. It's different in several respects from male gamete production, as you might expect. In the female, of course, the analogous structure of the testes in the female is the ovary. We all looked at those in the fetal pigs and so forth. The ovaries are retained within the abdominal cavity, whereas the testes are outside of the abdominal cavity.
But here's one of the big differences is that at the time of birth of a female child, every single cell that is potentially going to become an ovum or an egg is already present in the ovary. Okay, so it's not like males where we've got these stem cells that continually produce more and more spermatozoan. No, they're already all there and in place. And it's been estimated that at birth there may be as many as 2 million cells that could become ova within an ovary. But even at birth, it's estimated about half of those are already degenerating. So we're going to see that these cells over time will continue to degenerate. So the normal, the million cells that are the normal cells have all started the meiosis process, but they're frozen in prophase one. Okay, so the whole process has stopped there. Frozen in prophase one. And that meiotic process isn't going to continue until in any one of those ova until it goes to ovulation. So part of the maturation process of an ovum is continuing that meiotic process. Interestingly, though, in humans, what we would consider to be a mature ovum or egg that gets released from the ovary has only completed the first of the two meiotic divisions. So it will have completed meiosis one, but in humans, it's only if a sperm head penetrates the egg, if fertilization occurs, that second meiotic division even gets completed. It's not clear why that should be, why that would be the case, but that's what we see. So quite a different process going on. Because of continuing degeneration of the ova, it's estimated that at puberty there are probably only about 300,000 of those cells that are still viable. They continue to degenerate. Now that's probably plenty. Even if half of those were fertilized, that would be a lot of kids. So probably plenty. It's estimated that only 400 to 500 ever mature over the course of a woman's life. So out of all those millions that you start with, only 400 to 500 are ever going to mature. So as I said, just before ovulation, the first division of meiosis is completed, and then only with fertilization in humans does the second division ever get completed. So again, a very, very different process from what we saw in the formation of male gametes. Now, not only are those details different, but cytokinesis is different. Now remember, cytokinesis is the division of the cytoplasm when a nuclear division has occurred. And when we talked about mitosis a long time ago, we used to make a distinction. Mitotic division is the division of the nucleus, and then cytokinesis generally occurs, may not. Well, in the case of meiosis, same sort of a thing. Meiosis really describes the nuclear division, and then along comes cytokinesis. And in lab, you may remember at the end of that meiosis lab, you were shown some slides in the lily plant, the female gamete production there. We actually wound up with 4 haploid cells where cytokinesis hadn't occurred. There were 4 haploid cells within the original cell wall. So it doesn't always happen. Now in humans, we get a very, very unequal cytokinesis that occurs. And in lots of organisms, it happens this way. So if we were to track this process, we'd see something like this. So here's our diploid cell that we're going to start off with. And this is called a primary... I'm sorry? Oh. Thank you. I don't like to compete with that screen either. a primary oocyte. Okay, so that's what we call the cell that's going to undergo meiosis. And that's what I've been referring to as the as the ovum that's going to develop or whatever.
Same idea as the primary spermatocyte here, right? So the primary whatever oocyte is going to undergo meiosis.
What will happen at that first division is that cytokinesis will occur, but it's very, 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 very unequal, so that we wind up with one large cell and one small cell. And they're both haploid. We've completed meiosis one. They're both containing replicated chromosomes, so we've got to go through the second division of meiosis also, at least for this cell. Okay, but very, very unequal. So this is going to be called the secondary oocyte. That's that cell. But this cell up here is called a polar body. Polar body. So each one has one complete set of chromosomes. And you say, well, why in the world are we doing that? Why are we wasting it? Because this certainly, even though some people would argue that there's the potential for the polar body becoming fertilized, I would disagree with them. There's just not enough mass here, even if it were fertilized, to produce an individual. The reason this happens is to conserve the cytoplasm of the egg. You need enough cytoplasm, enough organelles, enough everything that's in that egg to support the early development of that embryo until such time as it can get nourishment from the outside. Now in humans, that happens fairly quickly. We talked in lab about how implantation occurs. You're looking at around a week or so, implantation into the uterine lining is occurring, and a little young placenta is starting to form and so forth. So in the human, we have to have enough material stored in that cytoplasm to probably last us a week or two until we get that little placenta going and things like that. In other organisms, that's not necessarily the case. Like, you know, bird eggs. Why are bird eggs so big? Well, it's because they're storing a tremendous amount of yolk and white, which is a lot of protein and so forth, nutrients for nourishing that young embryo until it hatches. And of course, you know, if you've ever seen a bird hatch, you know that they hatch fully formed and ready to go. Although they do have to grow up too, but they have to have, those eggs have to have enough material in them to create that little chick before it hatches. Frog eggs are relatively large eggs. They have to have, again, enough nourishing material in them in order to support development until the tadpole can hatch out of the egg. And so the meiosis process is designed to conserve that material as much as possible. And so we wind up with only a single gamete from meiosis in females, where we wound up with four gametes from meiosis in males. So in female reproduction, and this is pretty general for many, many different species and kingdoms even, we'll wind up with one large gamete that we'll call a female gamete from what we will then at that point call the female, and then we'll wind up with four smaller gametes from the male organism. So we're conserving cytoplasm. Now, if fertilization occurs in humans again, so with fertilization, then we're going to see this ovum go ahead and divide again. But what's it going to do? It's going to conserve the cytokinesis. It's going to conserve the cytoplasm again. And so let's call this 1N2C. This will be 1N1C, except there's going to be another sperm head in here, another 1N1C. So those two nuclei are going to then fuse into one during the fertilization process, and we'll get a second polar body. Sometimes this polar body out here will divide also, sometimes not, doesn't have to. So there may be three polar bodies, two or three polar bodies that we'll wind up with, and that one large, now fertilized egg, that one zygote.
bigger ones does not consume the smaller ones. The polar body is just going to degenerate.
So then how do we get to one end?
The river is fertilized, so the sperm contributed one.
One end? Oh, okay.
Yeah, the sperm contributed one haploid nucleus, and maybe I shouldn't have brought it into this. Using, but it's only if, in humans, it's only if fertilization occurs that you get this to happen. So that's why I did that, silly me.
So this would be, let's just say this is from sperm, and this was the set that was in the egg. Okay, so that's why I got that there. If this consumed these other guys, you still wouldn't get the nuclei. It would digest the nuclei too. So, but it doesn't. So let's not go down that road. So we get one single large gamete from the meiotic process in human and females, whereas in males we get four much smaller gametes as a result of that. Now, because the in humans, because the what we would call the mature ovum or the egg that gets released, because it's only finished the first meiotic division, then at ovulation what we're seeing is a secondary oocyte that's being released. It's not truly a mature egg, because in the mature egg you would expect just to have completed meiosis. So it's properly referred to as the secondary oocyte at ovulation. That's what we're going to have. Ovulation in humans. Now, the ovary is an interesting structure. We'll look in more detail at it in a minute. And picking up the secondary oocyte that's being released is an interesting process. The ovary is kind of an oval-shaped structure. You can imagine a three-dimensional oval-shaped structure. The ovulation can occur at any point on the surface of the ovary. It just depends on where the follicle inside the ovary was that was developing, that produced the egg, and so forth. So it can be released from any surface. But what's always intriguing is the fact that there's not necessarily a direct connection between the ovary and the oviduct. Now, that ovum has to wind up in the oviduct. That's the normal path. It'll get picked up by the oviduct and move down through the oviduct to the uterus. But there's no direct connection at the ovary end of the oviduct. It spreads out, okay, so it makes a membrane, kind of a fingered membrane, where you have these finger-like structures going out that kind of sweeps over the surface of the ovary, but doesn't by any means completely surround and cover the ovary. And so that's what's responsible for picking it up. Now, the cells lining the oviduct have cilia on them, and they create a current that helps to draw the oocyte that's been released into the opening. But there's no assurance that ovum is actually going to go in to the oviduct. And there have been situations documented where pregnancy has actually occurred outside of this whole thing. Now, pregnancy ordinarily occurs in the uterus, right? Some pregnancies will occur in the oviduct itself, which is not a good thing, because one of two things is going to happen, or both are going to happen. If the young embryo implants itself into the wall of the oviduct, either it's going to grow and burst the oviduct, okay, which is not good, or the oviduct is going to hold together and it's going to crush the young embryo. So either way, as I said, it's not a good thing. And in cases like that, doctors need to go in actually and surgically remove that and repair the oviduct. And oftentimes, the result of that is sterility, at least on the one side, because you get scar tissue and so forth. The oviduct itself is a really small tube, and it doesn't take much scar tissue to block it, and then all of a sudden, what are you going to do? You've only got one side that's functional. There are a lot of sexually transmitted diseases that will affect the oviducts and effectively block both of them. And when that happens, then there's no way that woman can get pregnant. There's no way for the sperm to get to the egg and so forth. So that's one. But there have been some documented cases where pregnancy has occurred outside of that whole system, and the young embryo is actually embedded into the abdominal wall, into the cavity, the perineum, and that young embryo and fetus have grown to maturity. Now, clearly, in a situation like that, that woman is not going to deliver that baby in the normal means. It's in the wrong place to begin with, so that would be an abdominal surgery to get in there. This would be extremely rare for something like this to happen, but there have been documented cases that generally, if something like that happens, it's just going to degenerate. It's not going to be able to create a placenta, be nourished, or anything like that. But there have been these rare cases where that happens. Fertilization of the egg oftentimes will occur up in the very upper regions of the oviduct, or possibly even outside of the oviduct before that egg is picked up. So there is that possibility. Now, it turns out that the membrane that's surrounding this broadened membrane of the oviduct up at the top, sweeping over the ovary, is very, very sticky. And once an ovulated egg, and it's not just the egg that gets kicked out, there's a mass of cells that are surrounding that egg also. So it's a whole mass of cells with the egg inside. Once that touches that membrane, then it sticks really well to that membrane, and that helps direct it down into the oviduct. So once it's kind of picked it up on the fingers, then that ovum is going to go down into the oviduct. We always think of the egg is being swept down the oviduct by the action of cilia, but it turns out that the oviduct itself will have peristaltic contractions, kind of like the esophagus, okay, where it'll kind of help to push that ovum, or that young embryo, as the case might be, down the oviduct towards the uterus. So a lot going on there to pick up, to capture that egg, to direct it in the right direction, to get it into the oviduct, to get it moving down the oviduct into the uterus, and deliver it eventually to the uterus. Let's take a look at some diagrams here real quick. I guess just look at the first diagram at the top of page 80. So, just some basic anatomy here. So here's kind of a longitudinal section of this area in a female. Here's the ovary. So the ovaries, it's kind of this oval-shaped structure here. Here's the oviduct, okay, and this is that broadened area that I was talking with you about that's kind of sweeping over the oviduct. It probably encloses the ovary better than that drawing shows, but that's where. Now, as I said, that ovulation, that ovum can be released from any surface. So you can see if it was released down here, it's a ways away from here, so it has to be captured and brought up here, trapped, and then moved down the oviduct. Or it could be released right underneath the opening to the oviduct. You know, it could be released anywhere along there. But it's going to move down. This is kind of an exaggeration, the size of this oviduct, the way that it's drawn. And you'll have a chance to see that in lab this week as we do a demonstration dissection of a pregnant cow uterus, and we look at all these different structures. We've also got a human uterus with the oviducts and ovaries attached that you can look at, some samples like that and so forth. So this feeds in then to the top of the uterus, and then it'll migrate down. Now if that ovum has been fertilized, then it's going to embed itself into the lining of the uterus. If not, it's just going to degenerate, and that's going to be kind of the end of it. So here's the uterus. This end of the uterus is what we call the cervix. It's a very tightly closed muscle that remains tightly closed until it's time to deliver the child, if there's a child to be delivered. And at that point in time, that cervix has to stretch, really relax and open up to allow the child to pass through on out the birth canal, the vagina, and on out. So that's the female reproductive system, at least the part that we're going to pay attention to. Okay, any questions about this before we talk about hormonal regulation of this process? We haven't talked about hormones yet. There are a lot of hormones involved in regulating the whole process and things going on. Okay, let's go on then to page 81. We'll come back to page 80 in a minute to use those diagrams to kind of pull together what I'm going to be telling you here. So the formation of gametes in humans is under hormonal control, especially in women, but in men also. We'll talk about that later. We'll come back to that in a few minutes. But in women, there's a very tight hormonal control over the regulation of the stimulation of the formation of the ovum, the stimulating the meiotic divisions and so forth, maturation of the ovum, and preparation of the uterus to accept an embryo if pregnancy occurs. So a lot of control. We talked quite a bit about hormones now, right? Even though we didn't have a section in here specifically geared up for hormones, we've talked a lot about them. Remember, they're small chemicals that are produced in one area by a structure we tend to call a gland, and they travel through the blood, they target another area. So we're going to be looking at several hormones that are produced in a couple of different areas in the body. And just keep in mind that all of these hormones that we're talking about are going to be traveling to their targets through the blood system, through the circulatory system, and eventually getting to their targets. So specifically, I said we call them glands. Specifically, we call these hormone-producing tissues endocrine glands. They produce hormones, okay, and in women there are three of these glands, or three tissues that behave as endocrine glands, that we're going to be interested in looking at. Okay, so one gland that we'll be looking at is the pituitary gland. Pituitary gland is incredibly important in the body. It produces so many different hormones. In this situation, we're going to be interested in two particular hormones that the pituitary produces. One's called the follicle stimulating hormone. Follicle stimulating hormone, and we're just going to abbreviate this FSH. FSH. And the second hormone that we'll be interested in tracking is one called the luteinizing hormone. And we'll just abbreviate this LH. Okay, so the follicle stimulating hormone and the luteinizing hormone. By the way, what I'm going to be telling you, that at least initially, is going to be a real simplified version of what's going on. And then I'm going to talk with you a little bit more about what's actually going on in the background. But I think we're going to kind of stick with the simplified version, and you'll see why in a few minutes. Actually, it's basically because... No, we'll come back to that. So, pituitary gland is producing these two hormones that are going to be important. We'll talk about the ovaries. So they have endocrine function. They produce hormones. And the two hormones that we're going to be particularly interested in, kind of tracking for the story that we're going to be looking at here, are going to be estrogen and progesterone. So pituitary producing FSH and LH, to ovaries producing estrogen and progesterone. And we'll talk about also about the placenta, which has its own set of endocrine functions, and be interested in tracking its production of estrogen, progesterone, and another hormone that I haven't mentioned yet called the human chorionic gonadotropin. Human chorionic gonadotropin that we can abbreviate with a small h, big C, big G. Okay? So, those are the hormones we're going to track. We want to know how are they interacting with each other? What's going on in this reproductive cycle in women? Now, a woman's reproductive system functions on about a 28-day cycle. That's kind of the average, although the normal range may be anywhere from 23 to 34 days. So those would be the outliers, and you've got kind of anything in between. But the majority of women will be on roughly a 28-day cycle for everything that we're looking at. The time of release of the ovum from the ovary is about midpoint in the cycle. So on a 28-day cycle, we would think at about day 14 is when ovulation is going to occur. And lots of things are going to be going on around that event in order to prepare the uterus for implantation if pregnancy occurs. If pregnancy doesn't occur, other things going on and so forth. So again, this is kind of a simplified version of what's actually happening. So if we go to the beginning of the cycle, if we go back to day one, thinking about our calendar, go back to day one. Day one is always the beginning of the menstrual cycle, menstrual bleeding. Okay, so that's caused by the shedding of the uterine lining. Pregnancy hasn't occurred, the uterine lining gets shed, and then we're going to see this going to build up again in preparation in the next cycle for pregnancy to occur. So we always start with day one. Not all mammals shed their lining like that, but humans do. So that's day one. If we looked at what was going on in the pituitary at day one, and you can follow along down here at the lower part of page 81, the interactions. Let's see if we can't fill in those blanks and make some sense there. So starting back there at day one, if we were to sample the blood and see what was going on, we see the pituitary was putting out FSH, follicle-stimulating hormone. Now, FSH targets the ovaries. And specifically, it's targeting the follicles within the ovaries. So we could identify them as ovarian follicles. Now, a follicle is simply a hollow ball of cells, right? Well, it's not hollow because it's always got something in it. And in this case, what's in it is that primary oocyte, or that secondary oocyte that gets released, is going to be within that ball of cells. So when we talk about it targeting the ovarian follicle, it's targeting actually the cells that are surrounding that primary oocyte. A follicle that hasn't been stimulated is really tiny. But under the influence of FSH, the follicle cells begin to divide and the follicle begins to mature. Now this is a process that doesn't happen just within the 28-day cycle. This is a process that happens over a period of months for the full maturation of the ovarian follicle to occur. It's thought that in a woman that the ovaries kind of take turns. I don't quite know how they know how to take turns, but 1 month the one ovary will release the, will ovulate, the next month the other one will ovulate, and back and forth. So it takes time for this process to occur, and we're just going to, it's going to seem like it just goes by really quick. Now FSH does, so FSH does exactly what it sounds like it does. It stimulates follicle development, follicle stimulating hormone. Okay, it stimulates follicle development. The maturing follicles then begin to produce estrogen. Maturing follicles produce estrogen. And the estrogen that's now being released and is being permeating the ovarian tissue, as well as being picked up by the blood, the estrogen actually targets three areas. Now, we've only got two listed there, so I'm going to have to add, have you add a third one in just a second. So the first area that it will target, it'll get into the blood, and it's going to target right back to the pituitary gland. And as the estrogen level builds up in the blood, it's going to cause the pituitary to not only produce less FSH, but it's going to cause the pituitary to release a lot of LH. So we see this kind of a subtle shift in the ratios of FSH to LH, and we get a whole bunch more, just a spike of luteinizing hormone that is shot out of the pituitary gland. And that happens by about day 12. So day one, we're seeing the follicle stimulating hormone, stimulating the follicles. We're seeing the follicles building up their level of estrogen that they're producing. We're seeing the pituitary gland then reduce FSH production and spike LH production, so that by about day 12 you get that big spike. So that's one thing that the estrogen does, is causes this shift in what the pituitary is producing and releasing. The second thing that it does is it targets the uterine lining and causes the cells of the uterine lining to start dividing, so they start thickening, so that we're now preparing in advance for pregnancy to occur or not. Okay, so it targets the uterine lining, causing those cells to divide. Now, it's not muscle cells. The uterus is a very, very muscular organ. And I think you're kind of sometimes tempted to think, oh, it's all muscle. No, there's lining cells that are not muscle cells. And those are the cells that are dividing and thickening within the uterus. So, estrogen is targeting the pituitary. It's targeting the uterine lining, causing the thickening. And the third thing it's doing is it's suppressing the further development of other follicles. So it's kind of like the biggest follicle, the most advanced, the most mature follicle, is going to suppress further development of other follicles so that we don't wind up with, say, 3 or 4 or 5 or 8 follicles all maturing at the same time. Now, there are some animals like cats and rats and rabbits and on, where they have multiple births. You'll have multiple follicles developing at one time. But in humans, that's not the case. The only way we get multiple births like that is if the woman is treated with hormones to stimulate follicle development. So in cases where a woman is not ovulating on a regular basis or something like that, you get treatments for that, hormone treatments, and then all of a sudden you can wind up with 6 or 8 ova being released at the same time and wind up with multiple births like that. That's one way that we wind up with that happening in the human population. Okay, so those three things. So if you can kind of think about it, kind of imagine what's going on here around day 11, day 12, we're getting the suppression of other follicles, preventing them from continuing to develop. We're getting the lining is developing. The pituitary is now pumping out LH. And so what's going on with the LH? So number three here, the pituitary is now producing less FSH, more LH, and actually putting out a huge spike of LH. And that targets the follicle. So it's going to go right back and target the follicle. And it causes three things again. So again, I'm going to ask you to add another thing here. It causes three things to happen with the follicle. Okay, number one is not your number one. Number one's the one I need you to add, but that's kind of minor. You can just add it down below. Is the presence of a high level of FSH stimulates meiosis in the maturing ovum. So it's the presence of that LH that's going to cause that primary oocyte to go ahead and complete that first meiotic division in humans. I'm sorry, what? So the LH targets the follicle and it stimulates meiosis by that maturing ovum to complete that first meiotic division. Stimulates meiosis. Okay, so that's the first thing that it does. So now we've got the secondary oocyte ready to go. The second thing that it does, which would be number one on your list, is it causes the follicle cells, or the follicle itself, to rapidly take up water. Now, you may remember from lab last week when you were looking at the mammalian, the ovary, the cross-section of the ovary, the cat ovary, and you were asked to identify a mature follicle, and you were looking for the big ones that had the follicle cells all around but had that big open space in the middle, right? That's a fluid-containing area in the middle. So the follicle is going to rapidly take up water into this space. And what that does over a period of a couple of days is ultimately it will cause that follicle to burst to the outside. And that's their ovulation event. So by bursting to the outside of the ovary, that allows that ovum that's been developing inside to be released from that follicle and released out of the ovary. So rapidly take up water and burst, which would be ovulation. But that's not the end of the story for LH. It continues to target those follicle cells and causes them to develop into a structure called the corpus luteum. So if you can imagine, we've got this follicle now that has expanded. It was fluid-filled. It's erupted to the outside. But really, most of the follicle cells stay within the ovary. Okay? And so once it's burst open, it's going to collapse on itself, no longer a fluid-filled center. And those cells now, the follicle cells that are still in the ovary, under the direction of LH, are going to develop into this other structure, this corpus luteum. And you can actually see it's a large structure that we find within the ovary. It's one of the things we're going to be looking for in lab this week. It's a sign, it's how we can tell which of the two ovaries actually ovulated in a pregnancy. If there's a corpus luteum in the ovary, that tells us that that's the site that ovulated. So, stimulates meiosis in the maturing oogonium, right? It causes the follicle to rapidly take up water and burst, causing ovulation, and then it causes that corpus luteum to the follicle tissue to develop into that corpus luteum. And you might say, okay, what's the big deal with that? Well, the corpus luteum turns out to be a really important structure, as you might imagine. So number four, the corpus luteum produces estrogen. So it continues that estrogen production that the follicle had been doing. So whatever the estrogen was doing, it will continue doing it. Right, so it produces estrogen and also produces progesterone, another one of our hormones that I mentioned that we'd be looking at here. So it'll produce progesterone. So the importance to the uterine lining, the estrogen, remember, was causing the cells of the uterine lining to divide and the uterine lining to thicken. The progesterone then specifically targets that also and causes the lining to become vascularized. Now, what does that mean, vascularized? That just means that we get a good blood supply built into it. Okay, which is what's going to be needed if pregnancy occurs and if implantation occurs, and for the placenta, because remember the placenta is where we get all the exchange occurring between the child and the mom and so forth. You need a really good blood supply in there in order that to make that happen. It's not that the fetal blood and the maternal blood ever mix there. They don't. But the placenta is where the fetal blood comes in very, very close contact with the maternal blood. And that's where the exchange occurs. Okay. So the corpus luteum produces the estrogen and the progesterone that target the uterine lining, causing it to thicken and become vascularized. And of course, it's also going to target the pituitary, continuing FSH suppression and things like that. And it'll also be targeting other follicles and preventing them from maturing at this point in time, because we don't want to have kind of multiple release of ova of if pregnancy occurs. Okay, so that's all going on. By now we're probably at what day are we at? Let me think about this. We're at around ovulation at day 14. And then the development of the corpus luteum. So right, day 17, 18, 19, somewhere in there. And if fertilization occurs, generally it occurs in the upper reaches of the oviduct. And it generally takes about 5 to 7 days for that to travel down the length of the oviduct. And during that time, early development's going to be happening. So by about 5 days or so, that young embryo is ready to implant. So by day 19 or so, the uterine lining is ready. It's ready for implantation to occur if fertilization has occurred. Now from here we can go one of two ways, right? Either fertilization occurred or it didn't occur, either implantation is going to occur or it doesn't. Let's track implantation doesn't occur, first of all. Okay, so fertilization of the egg doesn't occur, implantation doesn't occur. A few days later, the corpus luteum is going to start to break down. It'll start to degenerate. The LH level will have gone down in the blood. It's no longer supporting the corpus luteum, and it'll start to break down. And as the corpus luteum begins to degenerate, then the levels of estrogen and progesterone are going to start to drop and drop and drop. And by day 28, moving into day 1, the levels of estrogen and progesterone will be so low that the uterine lining can no longer be supported, and so the lining begins to be shed. So we're back to day 1 again. Okay, if implantation hasn't occurred, back to day 1, because the corpus luteum is now degenerating. Corpus luteum will degenerate and just form some scar tissue. Ovaries from younger women tend to be relatively smooth on the outside. Ovaries from older women tend to be rather bumpy on the outside because of the scar tissue that's formed from multiple corpus lutea and things like that going on within them. So, no implantation, back to day 1. What happens if implantation does occur? So if fertilization happens and that little embryo begins to implant, the first thing that's going to happen as it's implanting is that there will be this interaction between the embryonic tissue and the uterine tissue, the mom's tissue, to begin to form a placenta. The placenta itself is part embryonic in nature, part embryonic tissue, and part maternal tissue. Right? So it's going to start to form a placenta. One of the first things that young forming placenta does is to produce this other hormone, this human chorionic gonadotropin, the HCG. So if the embryo becomes implanted, number 5 down here, the embryo becomes implanted into the uterine wall, the placenta produces HCG. The human chorionic gonadotropin targets the corpus luteum. So it's going to feed back and it's going to target the corpus luteum, and it maintains it. It's the signal that maintains it. So the corpus luteum no longer degenerates. The corpus luteum continues to produce estrogen and progesterone, and at least for the first 3 months or so of pregnancy, that's what maintains the pregnancy. That's what maintains the uterine lining so that pregnancy can move forward, is the hormones from the corpus luteum. Now, eventually, the placenta itself will produce enough estrogen and progesterone to take over that function. And so at some point, 3 months or so into the pregnancy, the corpus luteum will start to break down, but not initially. Interestingly, with pregnancy tests, what is being looked for is HCG in the blood, or not in the blood, in the urine. Well, it could be a blood test too. But the little sticks looking for HCG, and if HCG is in the urine, then you'll get a positive test, because the only time you find HCG in a human female's body is when there's a placenta present. Okay, so with pregnancy. So that's the basis now for the pregnancy tests that are done. So we go one of two routes. Either implantation occurs and the corpus luteum is maintained by the HCG and the pregnancy goes forward, or implantation doesn't occur and the whole thing starts over again. Okay, any questions about that? I know it's a lot of information. Yeah.
The LH, to my knowledge, doesn't have any effect on the non-developing ones, and the estrogen has stopped the development, if that answers your question. So it's going to have the effect on the one that's still developing. Did that answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah, okay.
Can you briefly go over number 5?
Yeah, number 5, sure. So if an embryo becomes implanted, the placenta produces HCG, right? So that's the keynote there. That maintains the corpus luteum. And that keeps hormone production occurring. So the estrogen and progesterone production is maintained that the corpus luteum was producing. So it keeps those hormones being produced, which maintains the uterine lining. And eventually enough of those hormones are produced by the placenta to maintain the uterus alone without needing those. But at least for the first 3 months, though, it's really important. Any other questions? Okay, let's rest our brains for a minute then. And when we come back, believe it or not, I have more to tell you. Okay, let's... let's go back to page 80 and look at these diagrams and see how they relate to everything that I just shared with you that I talked about. And you always see diagrams like this of the ovary, right? And I like to think of them as kind of a time-lapse picture of what's happening, because you're never going to see, you know, the sequence like this or anything like that in the ovary. So if you would think of it that way, that would be really helpful. Kind of a time lapse. So back here, here's a real immature follicle. Okay, so that's in fact that's huge for an immature follicle. They're a whole lot smaller than that, but that's the drawing that we've got in there. Under the influence of FSH, those follicle cells start to grow and start to form that larger follicle. And here, let me see what you've got there. Yeah, okay.
So, primary oocyte, but remember, it's really, in humans, it has started meiosis with frozen and ovary, frozen, which brings up some interesting questions. If you've got a cell like that that's been frozen in prophase 1 for 35 years or more, what kind of environmental insults might affect that? Something we can talk about another time, but you wonder, you know, there's a lot of data about as women age and the effect that the mom's age might have on
genetic aberrations in the child, so especially Down syndrome and things like that. I wonder what effect might that have? But that's not what I'm saying. So we have this under the influence of FSH. Now, these large follicles, this large follicle here, is producing estrogen that's really suppressing the development of more of those follicles in there. So we'll have a sequence over time, we'll have a sequence of these follicles. Here's our mature follicle. There's that big fluid-filled center of it that I talked about. There are follicle cells around there and around here. Lots of follicle cells. And now we're under the influence of the luteinizing hormone, LH. And fluid's going to be picked up. And it's going to cause that to burst to the outside. What initially bursts out of that follicle is the fluid that's in here. And so you can watch and see that a lot of fluid will come out, whatever's in there, causing the collapse of that follicle, and then this area right here will be released, and that secondary oocyte will be released. Remember that LH is also stimulating the further meiotic division of this oocyte. So there's ovulation. Most of the follicle tissue remains in the ovary. Right? It's all this tissue around here. Just a small amount of it actually escapes during ovulation. And then under the influence of LH, it begins to form. It begins to divide and begins to form the corpus luteum. And the corpus luteum can be quite large. And you see, wow, does it really fill that much of the ovary? One of the things that I'm hoping to see in lab this week is that, yes, indeed, with pregnancy, corpus luteum can fill half that ovary. It can be a huge, huge structure in there. And when the corpus luteum is producing estrogen and progesterone that are helping to maintain that pregnancy. Without the pregnancy, though, then the corpus luteum will degenerate. You get a little bit of scar tissue, and we're kind of right back here again. And we're starting to pull it. So, that's what that diagram is all about. That's a little diagram. Over here, we've got the layout of the system, the reproductive system. So there's the ovary, there's the oviduct. These finger-like structures, you'll hear this term, I'm sure. These are called fimbria. Widening out of the oviduct on that end. And remember, they're going to kind of be sweeping over the ovary. And we'll hopefully be able to pick up an ovum once it's been released. Once it's picked up, it's carried down the oviduct by ciliary action, drawing it, and also by contractions of the oviduct, by helping push it along. But even though the oviduct is not a real long tube, in humans, it's maybe this long. You'll be able to see in the specimen that we've got in lab. It still takes maybe 5 days to transit that whole area. So if fertilization has occurred, then we're going to be getting cell divisions occurring as it moves down. I thought I had, I guess I don't. Okay, so you've got a diagram in your lab manual anyway that shows the development of that early embryo from off. And then it's going to be roughly 5 days old by the time it gets here, and we'll begin to implant in the morning. So that's what we have going on there. Okay, questions? Okay, so now it's time to have a little truth in advertising. I told you I was telling you kind of a simplified story of what's going on. So here's what's going on in the background that we didn't talk about. And that is that the pituitary gland is a manufacturer of hormones. That's what it does. It manufactures hormones. But it
gets its marching orders, as it were, from the hypothalamus of the brain. So if you were to look at a cross-section of the brain, you'd see something like this. Here's the hypothalamus sitting down here, deeply embedded at the bottom of the brain here and underneath of the brain. And here's the pituitary gland sitting right in that vicinity, right beneath it. So the pituitary gland is manufacturing all sorts of different hormones. But it's the hypothalamus that's actually directing the release of those hormones. So where I kind of wasn't telling the whole truth with you was when I was talking about, say, for example, the estrogen feeding back to the pituitary and causing the pituitary to shift production and increase production of LH. The estrogen is really targeting the hypothalamus. And it's affecting what are called releasing factors. It's affecting how many of those releasing factors are being released, so that that's going to then control how much of FSH and how much of LH is being released by the pituitary gland, manufactured in there and released from there. So the reason I kind of ignored that initially is it's just too many extra words. And I think we'll continue pretending that it's the pituitary gland that's actually getting targeted by the estrogen and so forth. But just keep in mind that it's really a little more complex. It's the hypothalamus that's actually regulating the release of hormones by the pituitary. And that is not just for this system. It's for any hormone that the pituitary releases. The hypothalamus is actually going to be directing the release of that particular hormone from the pituitary. So the pituitary gland is the factory. The hypothalamus is the control center for the shipping out, the release of those things that are being produced by the pituitary gland. Okay, so truth in advertising there. Now, gamete production in women is cyclic due to hormone feedback. Okay, so we've seen that. The gamete production is on a roughly a 28-day cycle. All right, and that's because as those follicles begin to develop and mature under the influence of FSH, they're producing the estrogen, which is targeting the hypothalamus pituitary and causing the pituitary to shift in its production of things. Basically, we're shutting down further gamete production when you have that one most mature follicle in the ovary that's developing. And so because of these kind of hormonal feedbacks that we see within the system, we get a very cyclic nature to human ovum production, which is really what you would like. You don't want to think about continually producing ova and continually having fetuses at different stages developing and so forth. That system just doesn't sound good. It doesn't work right. So we do see that the gamete production is cyclic. In males, it's not so. So that's another difference. We were talking about difference between male and female gamete production earlier on in the lecture, right? So there are a lot of differences. And in fact, let's talk about males in terms of hormones. What hormones are regulating sperm production? And it turns out that the very same hormones that are involved in female reproduction are also involved in male reproduction. Okay? So, in males, the pituitary is also releasing FSH. But in males, the FSH targets the seminiferous tubules, stimulating sperm production. Now the difference is that, well, first of all, there are no follicles, right? So it's kind of a misnomer, follicle stimulating hormone. But it's doing the same thing. It's stimulating gamete production. Right? So the difference is that though, there's no feedback that will, during part of the month, shut down spermatozoan production like there is in females. Okay, so we're constantly getting a supply of FSH. There is some feedback. And it actually, if you looked on a daily cycle, there is a daily cycle in sperm production. So there are certain times in the day that where more might produce and certain times where there's less produced. But it's not on this global scale. It never gets shut down completely in males like it does in females. So we think of it as not being cyclic. In fact, the cycle is pretty minor compared to the volume of sperm being produced. So we think of that as being non-cyclic. But FSH is the hormone that's stimulating sperm production. The pituitary also releases LH. But when the hormone in males was first discovered, it wasn't realized that it was the same hormone as in females. And so people came up with a different name. They called it the interstitial cell hormone, interstitial cell stimulating hormone. Or ICSH. So that was what was first discovered. And it does what it sounds like. It's going to target the interstitial cells. Now, remember back when we looked at the structure of the testes? It was filled with Wilsoniferous tubules, right, where sperm production is occurring. But then it was packed with these other cells surrounding the Wilsoniferous tubules. Those were the interstitial cells. So ICSH is targeting those interstitial cells in the testes. It's going to have nothing to do with sperm production because they're not involved in that, right? They're out. They're not part of the seminiferous tubule. But what the interstitial cells do, this stimulates them to produce male hormones, notably testosterone. So the testosterone is coming from the interstitial cells, and of course that's where males get a lot of the secondary male characteristics, hair, deep voice, musculature, and all of those kinds of things from testosterone levels. And so that's what the ICSH is doing. Again, why isn't male reproduction cyclic? Well, we don't see a complete shutdown. We never see a complete shutdown of sperm production unless something goes wrong with the system. Something can happen so that the stem cells get damaged or something like that. Well, that's a whole different thing. Ordinarily, it's not cyclic, except maybe on that little daily cycle that I mentioned to you. So some real differences between male and female. We go back, you know, 4 gametes versus 1, 4 in male versus 1 in the female. Kind of continual sperm production in the male with cyclic ovum production in the female. And so forth. Some big differences between the two. Questions? Yeah. Yes. Yeah, it turns out that ICSH is identical to LH. Yeah. Didn't know that at first, but people were surprised. Anything else? Any other questions? Well, then I'm going to stop there. And see most a lot of you in lab, and the rest of you are Thursday.